by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are. Rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. This hour is going to consist of a couple of wonderful clips that I discovered. Dr. Brzezinski, who is a genius, a called genius at foreign affairs, will lead off with the first clip. And he's going to talk about Russia. And he's going to talk about what Russia is trying to do and what Putin in particularly is trying to do in Russia and bring it out of this, the doldrums of the Middle Ages and the wars that they've gone through, and to establish Russia as a world power. So go ahead and listen to that clip. And then see what you think about it, and we'll rejoin the broadcast right after the end of that clip, and then we'll discuss a few of the points that he makes.
It's a pleasure to be here. Let me try to discuss the implications for the European security architecture of what Wolfgang Ischinger just addressed, namely the problem of the relationship of Russia to the West and Ukraine. What we are seeing in Ukraine, in my judgment, is not a peak, but a symptom of a more basic problem, namely the gradual but steady emergence in Russia over the last 6 or 7 years of a quasi-mystical chauvinism, a relationship that the Russians feel is needed because of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the partial disintegration of the long-established Russian Empire. It's a longish report, but it's worth reading for those who are interested in international affairs. It deals particularly with several key concepts that this new view of the world contains, a view of the world created by the need the Russians around Putin and Putin himself have felt for a more comprehensive interpretation of what is the nature of Russia's position in the world and its relationship with the world and the West in particular. And it's in this context that the Ukrainian issue then becomes significant. And the key concepts of it, this report written by a group of people of some prominence in Moscow, involves four basic concepts. That of, and I quote, a divided people. Secondly, the theme of, quote, protecting compatriots abroad, unquote. Then more broadly, the Russian world, Russkii mir in Russian, and the importance of acknowledging and sustaining, embracing and promoting, quote, the great Russian civilization. I mention this because I think it would be an error to think that Crimea and Ukraine are just the products of a sudden outrage. They are to some extent in terms of timing. It would have been much smarter for Russia to have what has been happening happen about 10 years from now, when Russia would be stronger, economically more solid. But it happened, and these concepts are important. A divided people is the point of departure for the chauvinistic claim that Russia's sovereignty embraces all Russians, wherever they are. And that has, for anyone familiar with European history, some ominously familiar sounds. prior to World War II. It leads, of course, to the concept of protecting compatriots abroad. And that has special meaning for those countries which do have Russian ethnic nationals living in their society and who border on Russia. The divided people and the protecting of compatriots abroad then raises the question of the Russian world. And the notion here is of an organic, integral unity between all Russians, irrespective of their territorial location. Unless that territorial location can be altered favorably in reuniting the Russian people. Think of the Baltic states. And last but not least, the conviction that Russia is not part of the Western civilization, is also not a part of China. It is not part of the Muslim world. Russia itself is a great civilization, a world civilization, which emphasizes a set of principles, some of which are not unfamiliar to our own society, such as, for example, strong commitment to a particular religion, but much stronger than in the West, where religion is part of a more complex social arrangement. The notion that the great Russian civilization stands for certain basic values, not only religious, but in terms of interpersonal relationships, to some extent, for example, condemning some of the changes in the relationship between the sexes and within the sexes that are now taking place in the world. In effect, Russia protects the integrity of certain basic beliefs that have characterized Christianity. But in the Russian view, Christianity is now betraying or permitting to slip away. Mm-hmm. So this is a comprehensive outlook and an ambitious outlook, and an outlook which justifies then the conclusion that Russia is a world power. And nothing has hurt Putin lately in some of the international dialogue with the West than the words of President Obama, which credited Russia with being a significant regional power. He didn't have to say more in order to score a point that hurt. That is, therefore, an important point of departure for dealing with the Ukraine issue. The Ukraine issue is not a sudden peak, but a symptom, as I have said, of a basic problem, the emergence of the policies packaged within the larger philosophical framework which I've described. What can we therefore expect? If Ukraine, in fact, is its manifestation, that problem will be difficult to resolve, and I think it will take time to resolve. But, of course, resolution of it need not be a unilateral solution if the West has a stake in it, and the stake has to be then crystallized into a meaningful policy. The Ukraine problem may fade if it is contained, and especially if the Russian increasingly cosmopolitan middle class, which is surfacing but not dominant currently, becomes politically more important, perhaps repelled by its sense of vulnerability and disappointment in Putin, and at some point assumes a more significant political role when Putin has passed from the stage. But when? There's no way of predicting it. It could be soon, it could be a long time, but also a great deal will depend on whether what Ukraine has become as a symptom becomes a success or a failure from Putin's point of view. So, in brief, the stakes are significant. In the most immediate sense, the stake involves, of course, the issue that the use of force in Crimea and the ongoing and sustained effort to destabilize parts of Ukraine poses a threat to the post-World War II notions of international arrangements, and particularly the exclusion of the use of force in resolving territorial issues. That has been a cardinal assumption of the European order after World War II. And Russia has been part of it, including through the treaties that it has signed. But it now is challenging that. That is a significant threat in a broad sense, and an immediate threat, psychologically at least, but potentially, in view of Crimea, militarily, to the Baltic states, to Georgia, to Moldova. And more vaguely, indirectly, but perhaps potentially more successful than the others, Belarus. Because Belarus does not have any external protection. The others that I've mentioned do in varying degrees. It follows from what I'm saying that the Ukrainian problem is a challenge that the West, by which I mean the United States and Europe, and NATO particularly, must address on three levels. We have to effectively deter the temptation facing the Russian leadership regarding the use of force. We have to deter the use of force, most simply put. We have to, secondly, to obtain the termination of Russia's deliberate efforts at the progressive or continuing destabilization of parts of Ukraine. It's very hard to judge how ambitious these goals are, but it is not an accident that in that one single portion in which the Russians actually predominate, one single portion of Ukraine in which they actually predominate, the use of force has been sophisticated. The participants in the effort have been well armed, even tanks, certainly effective anti-aircraft weaponry. All of that is something that even disagreeable, disaffected citizens of a country to which they feel they do not belong would be storing somewhere in their attic or in their basement. These are weapons provided, in effect, for the purpose of shaping formations capable of sustaining serious military engagements. It is a form of interstate aggression. You can't call it anything else. How would we feel if all of a sudden, let's say, the drug-oriented gangs in the United States were armed from abroad, from our southern neighbor, by equipment which would permit violence on that scale on a continuing basis? So this is a serious challenge. So that is the second objective. And the third objective is to promote and then discuss with the Russians a formula for an eventual compromise, assuming that in the first instance the use of force openly and on a large scale is deterred and the effort destabilized is abandoned. That means in turn the following, and I will be quite blunt regarding my own views on the subject. Ukraine has to be supported if it is to resist. If Ukraine doesn't resist, if its internal disorder persists in its incapacity to organize effective national defense doesn't transpire, then the Ukrainian problem will be resolved unilaterally, but probably with consequential effects that will be destabilizing in regards to the vulnerable states and to the totality of the East-West relationship. For the forces of Chernobylism, the forces of a new sort of world self-definition will become more strident. And they do represent the most negative aspects of contemporary Russian society, a kind of thirst for nationalism, for self-fulfillment, gratification of the exercise of power. Something which is not pervasive in the new middle class, which is the long-range alternative, but which is certainly not on top of political influence. If Ukraine has to be supported so that it does resist, the Ukrainians have to know that the West is prepared to help them resist. And there's no reason to be secretive about it. It would be much better to be open about it and to say to the Ukrainians and to those who may threaten Ukraine, that if you resist, if you Ukrainians resist, you will have weapons and will provide some of those weapons in advance of the very act of invasion. Because in the absence of that, the temptation to invade and to preempt may become overwhelming. But what kind of weapons is important? And in my view, these should be weapons designed particularly to permit the Ukrainians to engage in effective urban warfare of resistance. There's no point trying to arm the Ukrainians to take on the Russian army in the open field. Thousands of tanks, modern army, well organized for some purposes, overwhelming force. But there is a history to be learned from urban resistance in World War II and most recently in Grozny, Chechnya, which resisted for 3 months in house-to-house fighting. And there are some moving examples from World War II, which I do not need to reiterate. The point is, if the effort to invade was to be successful politically, it would have to incorporate taking the major cities. If the major cities, say Kharkiv, say Kiev, were to resist and street fighting became a necessity, it would be prolonged and costly. And the fact of the matter is, and this is where the timing of this whole crisis is important, Russia is not yet ready to undertake that kind of an effort. It will be too costly in blood, paralyzingly costly in finances, and it would take a long time and create more and more international pressure. So I feel that we should make it clear to the Ukrainians that if you are determined to resist, as they say they are, and seemingly they are trying to do so, though not very effectively, we will provide them with anti-tank weapons, handheld anti-tank weapons, handheld rockets, weapons capable for use in urban short-range fighting. This is not an arming of Ukraine for some invasion of Russia. You don't invade a country as large as Russia with defensive weaponry. But if you have defensive weaponry and you have access to it and you know it's arriving, you're more likely to resist. And hence that acts as a deterrence. And that, in turn, can permit then more effective operations to terminate some of the violence that is being sponsored on the borders between Ukraine and Russia. That, I think, would help in any case to contain the risk and the temptation to resolve this issue by force of arms on the Russian side in the context of a mood of great ecstasy over the Crimean success, which was quick and decisive, and which encountered no resistance. The temptation to seek its repetition can be quite strong and appealing to a political leader who desperately needs a major success. But at the same time, we have to engage in some exploration of possible arrangements for a compromise outcome, especially if it becomes clear to the Russians and to Mr. Putin that either destabilizing Ukraine or taking it by force poses great risks and may not be attainable. That has to be accompanied, therefore, by an effort to engage them in a dialogue. What should be the formula for such a possible compromise? I think it's relatively simple, in fact. Ukraine can proceed with its process, publicly endorsed by an overwhelming majority of Ukrainian people, of becoming part of Europe. But it's a long process. The Turks have been promised that outcome, and they have been engaging in that process already for 60 years. In other words, it's not done very quickly. Therefore, the danger to Russia is not an imminent, and the negative consequences are not so destructive. But at the same time, clarity that Ukraine will not be a member of NATO. I think that is important for a variety of geopolitical reasons. If you look at the map, it's important from the psychological, strategic point of view. Hence, Ukraine will not be a member of NATO. But by the same token, Russia has to understand that Ukraine will not be a member of some mythical Eurasian Union that President Putin is trying to promote on the basis of this new doctrine of a special position for Russia in the world and special claims outside of Russia vis-à-vis some of its fellow natives. Ukraine will not be a member of the Eurasian Union, but Ukraine can have a separate trade agreement with Russia, particularly taking into account the mutual benefits of the fact that certain forms of exchange and trade are mutually beneficial. Agricultural products, for example, from Ukraine to Russia. Industrial products that Russia needs and are being produced in Ukraine. Not many people realize that some of Russia's best rockets, most of the engines for Russian civil aviation, and some of the rockets used by the United States are produced in Ukraine. It's a profitable and successful industrial enterprise. And that, therefore, should be continued under an arrangement whereby Ukraine and Russia have a special treaty. I think something like this might actually at some point become appealing. And it should be surfaced, but it should be surfaced in the context of an open, not covert, but an open actions designed to convince the Russians that any use of force will have negative but enduring consequences for Russia itself, not involving a threat to Russia's security, but involving rising costs of the assertion of Russia's power at the cost of Ukrainian independence. In my view, in that context, NATO should also act somewhat more assertively in reducing the insecurity of those NATO countries that border on Russia and happen to have, on the average, about 25% of its population constituted of Russian nationals. I speak specifically of Estonia and Latvia. America has committed its presence there. I would think it would be very productive if, in addition to America, some leading European states, notably Germany, France, and Great Britain, deployed some symbolic forces in these three countries, so that they're there too, and not just Americans, on a regular basis, so that this would reaffirm the fact that NATO stands, in the context of this problem, together. In international politics, symbolism is as important as decisiveness, and symbolism can avert the necessity for extreme measures. Given the current consequences of the very massive expansion of NATO in the last several decades to 28 members, it might be also appropriate, in the light of the ongoing experience that we are in the process of assimilating, to take another look at the structure of NATO itself. And I have in mind particularly a review of the historical paradox involved in its not much mentioned, but potentially very important, Article 5. Article 5 is the article which provides for the procedure that the alliance follows in undertaking a military response to an aggression directed at it in general, or at one or two or more of its members. You doubtless recall that Article 5 has a provision that decisions to engage in hostilities by the alliance have to be unanimous, which in other words means that a single country has a veto. It was the United States that insisted on this provision when NATO was first formed, and it insisted on it in order to obtain popular support from it in the American Congress, from the isolationist portions of the American body politic, which feared that an alliance of this sort would violate American tradition of no foreign entanglements. The argument was, this gives America what it needs to avoid a foreign entanglement. Unfortunately, today, with 28 members of varying degree of capacity for participating in military action, and unfortunately of some varying degree of genuine political commitment to some of the security assumptions of the alliance, the situation has become reversed. It is some of the new allies that may be tempted in some circumstances to invoke Article 5. Not entirely preventing NATO from responding, because I'm convinced that if that were to happen, after some prolonged debates, much resentment, internal threats, the country that was trying to prevent NATO from acting would be persuaded to join, or de facto taken out of the alliance. But I think it would be wiser to review this provision in a more patient atmosphere, in spite of the circumstances that prevail today. One possible solution might be simply the adoption of a note of the provision that there will be no veto right in the alliance for sustained, enduring underperformers of jointly agreed commitments. Some members of NATO don't meet their commitments even by some remote approximation. They just do not. And hence their membership in NATO is a free ride altogether. Why should a member that doesn't meet NATO commitments practically in total then have the right to veto the other members' right to engage in collective self-defense? It's an anomaly and potential source of gridlock and confusion. As this crisis is gradually resolved, I hope NATO will take another look at it and will also look at the issue of additional new members in NATO more critically. It doesn't follow that a country in whose security NATO has an interest has to be in NATO. NATO can have an interest in its security, but without having it in NATO, and have a variety of understandings regarding how it might respond. There is some talk of new members in the EU, and perhaps some of these will seek NATO membership. And in recent years, some countries have obtained NATO membership while being territorially remote from the possible conflicts on the east-west dividing line. I think more discretion here may be actually beneficial, and some reflection on this subject might in fact enhance NATO credibility and create some pressure on those members who wish to be active members in NATO to do more to meet the commitments they have formally undertaken. Finally, and looking much further ahead, I think that one way or another, with or without a compromise solution, Crimea is going to become a serious economic burden for Russia. There is no way that the kind of economic activity in which Crimea has been able to engage, and quite profitably, named as a major source of tourism and visits and international liners on a large scale coming into its ports and foreign tourists engaging in trade, collection of souvenirs and so forth, can be sustained. As long as the international community doesn't formally recognize the incorporation of Crimea into Russia, it means that the exploration of the underwater resources within Crimea's territorial confines of the sea cannot be undertaken by international companies because they'll be subject to suits from a variety of interested parties. In brief, Russia faces the prospect of the necessity of subsidizing on a significant scale economic activity in Crimea to the benefit of its citizens. Prices, consumer prices, have already risen threefold since the incorporation of Crimea into Russia. This situation creates a potentially serious liability for Russia, which already is in a relatively weak economic position. Beyond that, there is the potential reality, which I think will become an enduring fact as Ukraine succeeds, that Russia in the process has created the enduring reality of hostility towards Russia on the basis of some 40 million people. Unlike many other Slavs, Ukrainians have not been anti-Russian historically. And certainly there's no comparison between its attitude traditionally towards Russia and that of the Poles next door. The Poles have repeatedly fought for their independence against the Russians and have strong feelings and enduring feelings on this subject. Enmity towards Russia is new, but it's becoming very intense. And the entire new generation of Ukrainians born in freedom and national sovereignty reflected the strongest. Ukraine, therefore, will involve not only an enduring problem for Russia in that respect, but the permanent loss of a huge swath of territory, the greatest loss of territory suffered by Russia in the course of its imperial expansion. This may, in turn, eventually begin to work against this new mythology regarding Russia's place and role in the world with which I started my presentation. it may be refuted by realities. And this is why I am increasingly hopeful that the new emerging Russian middle class, realizing that the kind of mythology that Putin has adopted, and which a significant portion of the less educated, more chauvinistic Russians have absorbed and embraced, is the road to nowhere. That the real place of Russia as an important country is in Europe, as a major European country. And they'll be reminded of that imperative every time they look to the East and ask themselves, what does that mean for the future of Russia? Thank you.
I hope you listen to that carefully, because what is going on now is that you have, Dr. Brzezinski, and particularly Henry Kissinger, and then the neocons have been very influential during George W. Bush's administrations, and even before then in the Cheney, when Cheney was vice president there under George Bush. So, old man Bush. So what has happened is that he's searching around, and if you'll notice that he ended his speech at the Wilson Center there in June, on the note that Russia's future belonged to the West, to the Western Europe. But what has really been going on that I see in more detail, let's get into what's really been going on. And really, you have to go back to the end of World War II, the rise of the Cold War that was fueled by Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, and it fueled the military-industrial financial complexes to where they could make a heck of a lot of money. Now, that's what's been really going on, and that's what we're beginning to see manifest now in Putin. After in 89, when the wall came down, the Berlin Wall, and then later on to that, you had the breakup of the Soviet Union and the loss of many of their former republics. Well, when this occurred, then NATO, under the leadership of the European powers, and especially the UK, France, and the United States, ran in there and grabbed hold of as many of those formerly Eastern Bloc countries as they could. And they started converting those countries over to NATO countries. Well, this put Russia on notice, the Russian Federation, which was trying to grope their way through a bad economic period coming out of the Soviet breakup. And so as they groped their way through the darkness into a more firm footing, and it was oil and gas and so forth that did bring them out, as they groped their way through, all the time these Western countries, these Western powers were going in there and grabbing up and fomenting these color revolutions and so forth. And they did a heck of a lot in securing most of those formerly Eastern Bloc countries into NATO countries. Well, this presented a real threat to the motherland, to the Russian motherland. And so Putin is actually reacting to that, but also he's trying to establish, and this is where Brzezinski describes it as some mystical chauvinist, international Russian type of image that he's trying to establish. But he's trying to do more than that. He's trying to fend off this intrusion, what he feels, into his Western border countries, into Mother Russia, and the Russians really feel threatened. And that's really what his reaction in the Crimea is and the Eastern Ukraine. Brzezinski goes on to say that they should go in there to the Ukraine and provide to the Ukrainian army anti-tank weapons and man-pad units to offset the Russian incursion and the fueling of the eastern Ukrainian area against the main central government in the Ukraine. The main government in the Ukraine is rife and with corruption. The previous two or three administrations and the previous one are undergoing all kinds of different corruptive types of factors. So it's not easy to really address the Ukraine in a way that you normally would see it. And try to speak of it in academic terms because it defies this, see. The real world is not what you learn in, at the political science schools and the universities. It is other than that because there's a lot of dynamics that are hidden. And you just don't learn that without being experienced out there in the real world. During this intervening period when Russia was off balance and trying to grope their way through to some kind of to reorganize and to regain power, which they had lost during this letdown period, this breakup period, the Aspen Institute, the Wilson Center, all of these other international institutions going in there, starting to establish economic schools of economics. That's one of their primary tools, is to go in and convert over the intellectuals to economic schools to establish economic thought, the Western economic thought, which gives rise then and supports modern banking and financial operations. This is one of their key ways to recruit a country to the Western way of thinking. And so then they become subject to and subservient to the modern financial and banking systems of which they want to go in and grab hold of. So listen carefully to this and come back and to our site. It's thesecrettruth.com. And Brzezinski is saying some very, very important things here. And he's putting us on alert that Putin should not look to the east, but actually the policies that were carried out by the neocons and by Brzezinski and Kissinger then resulted in Russia becoming more paranoid and looking to the east to solve their problems. That's why they established the BRICS, which is a brand new international financial development bank, and it's got some very, very powerful membership, of which Brazil is one of those, which has a development bank that's actually bigger than our World Bank here in this country. So what you're seeing is some dynamics being played out, international financial shenanigans being played out here, and America and Western Europe, because of the neocons and their misguided strategy, I believe, the geopolitics of this thing, have driven Putin to look to the east, to India, and then to China. And those are natural, you know what I mean, customers also for his oil and gas coming out of the Caspian Sea and so forth. Now, this coming clip has to do with Alex Jones. And I want you to listen also to this very, very carefully. It's just a short clip. But he says more about the dynamics in here than you're going to hear from most people. What we have in here is a tremendous description in his own mind. He's quite a student of history. But what he's done is combined much of the conspiratorial scholarship that I would say in research that he's been uncovering along with history. Now, my little saying about history is historians, storytellers. So it depends on who writes that history will determine actually what is going to result in the long run as far as the written history of a former nation or a previous regime or civilization. So you've got to be very careful there. Alex gets into some of the early rise of the black nobility in Venice, in Venice and Italy, and then the sweeping across which occurred later of these financial powers into Northern Europe and on into, and finally the eventually takeover through William the Conqueror of England. And that's what you have to see there from a historical viewpoint, is that William the Conqueror went in there and subdued the kings that were in power at the time, and by the Saxon kings, and when he finally subdued them, he set up a doomsday book, and he took an inventory of all the property in the kingdom. And then he took that property and started taxing it very heavily. So today, all that served as a model for subsequent nations to go in and seize control, maintain a control and dominance by force, and begin a taxation period that that has no end. In the previous Brzezinski clip, there's going to be, I'm going to put his speech up so you can click on it and download a Word for Windows file. And also, there'll be another file that you can download from the Wilson Center that will give the complete speeches of the other three commentators. But Brzezinski's speech is very important to listen to, because in there he lays out his so-called fear of Russia and creating this new international Russian model of man, you know, this new idea. And that's what all nations have, is that they have a mythology. Our mythology rises against our struggles and our overcoming with Great Britain and the monarchy, and where every man now in America could be a king, where we were fighting against one king that ruled the United Kingdom. So there's these mythologies that every nation begins to subscribe to, and their storytellings about the founding of the nations, the overcoming of adversities and hardships and so forth. And that's really one of the stories here of Russia. There is a paper that Brzezinski refers to that I will have up also for you to download, and it's about creating the idea of Russia itself and what that stands for, what they're wanting to do. It's Russia is beginning to turn its face towards Orthodox Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and it's growing within Mother Russia. And Putin, unknown to some, is very, very religious. And also, before Alexander Solzhenitsyn died, he and Putin became friends of all things. And Solzhenitsyn even saw Putin as someone that could unify, consolidate, and bring Russia back to its previous glory, so to speak. They had turned their back on the Tsar system, and they had also turned their back on this new thing, this new Russian worker, this communist Russian worker type of ideal or image that the Bolsheviki's created. But those Bolsheviki were backed by Western financial powers, so you can't ever rule them out totally either. So, I mean, it's the history itself, it's written. So history hyphen storytellers, again, they're going to leave out some of the very, very most important things, like the Bolshevik Revolution financed by Western banking interests, both in Europe, Western Europe, and America. And the Trotsky was sent over there by these early on. And Lenin was put in a train out of Switzerland and went in with a train load of gold to undermine the existing governments in Russia, and they were highly successful, and way beyond what they could have imagined their success to be. So anyway, listen to this clip. The first one, like I said, is Dr. Brzezinski. The second one is Alex Jones on one of his programs. I pulled that out of there because it has such a wide swath of understanding of this total system, see, that we're up against. And it does go back to some previous history, which is also all important. So I've never heard him speak quite as general but insightful as Alex did the day that I listened to this particular, statement, this pronouncement that he made. Anyway, come back to thesecrettruth.com. You can find all of these clips on there. You can listen to the program again. We'll have it up on the site. You can download the Brzezinski papers, his script of his speech, but also download some of that, the ideas that the scholars in Russia and the think tanks are trying to establish.
All right, I want to go to a lot of calls, so I'm not going to belabor this point. But let me explain full spectrum dominance as simply as I can. But it's full spectrum, so it's very complex, but also very simple. if you are global financial combines that for 500 years on record or longer with the black nobility of Venice, the Venetians, this is on record mainline history. What I'm telling you is known by historical and economic scholars. This is not my view of things. This is prima facie admitted. Transferred their system to England in the last 500 years. Napoleon was a competing faction of the very same group. Out of Corsica. Out of Italy. He wasn't even French. And that was a battle between the two Venetian systems, the two Italian systems that had the Roman technology of governing and manipulation, between the Britannic forces and the Napoleonic forces. Okay? I'm simplifying this as much as I can. There's Knights Templar stuff, Merovingian stuff tied into it, a lot of different philosophies, but the main banking, shipping, combine, British East India, Dutch East India operation. Model that is globalism and modern mercantilism today. They created Hitler on record. Didn't run him, didn't control him. Found him, trained him, set him up, pointed him at Europe to blow everything up as Napoleon Part II, to bring in a new global Britannic model based on the United States. That doesn't mean Hitler was good, that he was set up. Just like ISIS is being set up in Al-Qaeda. They're horrible. They're real. They're killing people. But they're being funded and protected and turned loose by the same Britannic model. Doesn't mean British people. It's a model. It's a system. It's a game plan. Okay? And other countries and groups do it as well, but they try to mimic that model. The only way to beat that model is truth going over the top and circumventing the whole thing and pulling back and exposing the hat trick. You don't beat it with the ring of Sauron. You become it. But everyone tries to adopt it to defeat it. I'm going to stop right there. The Russians were set up because the Tsars weren't part of the European or British group. They were cousins to the British and were a German bloodline and had been quietly off and on working with the Germans, not in World War I, but were getting back in bed with them at the end of that, so they had to be taken out. And the British put this in the newspapers at the time in World War I. They called it the German problem, that they were out producing science and technology and dominating through soft power and not through Britannic power. So they had to be destroyed. So they destabilized them, had assassinations, got the Austrian-Hungarian Empire to get into a fight with them. And it was their cousins they were fighting with. It was German Transylvanians in Russia, Germany, and England running the whole show. But they had adopted Machiavellian technologies, which themselves were Venetian black nobility programs. Okay, so those are the different pieces of the puzzle. So when I sit here and say the globalists are trying to overthrow Russia, Russia took the money of the Rothschilds, stabbed the globalists in the back, double-crossed them. Putin double-crossed a bunch of them. He double deals with them as well. Putin's been poisoning and killing some of them. There's a real war going on here. They're really trying to do their own New World Order right now. Doesn't mean it's good. Doesn't mean I trust them. But there's a certain KGB group that doesn't want to kill all the Russians and that are nationalistic. And they met with Solzhenitsyn. He decided to leave the U.S. He went back. Putin was a secret acolyte of Solzhenitsyn later, was reportedly there when he died. I mean, I've done the research on all this, okay? And they've made the decision not to put cancer viruses in all their shots and kill all the Russians. They've decided to not go with the full eugenics model and go with a Russian bear, new nationalistic takeover system. And if the old guard likes red stars on things, they'll go with it. But they're going with more of a strongman El Jefe model. I don't endorse it. They're trying to survive, though. The globalists are trying to bring them down, folks, just like they're trying to bring down our country, bring down our borders, bring down our standard of living, take our guns, break the patriarch, break the male, not to empower women. This is a scientific, it's like space aliens landed. The globalists are that advanced with their technotronic, over-the-horizon, Google future-predicting system. And an old mafia of the Russians does not want to go under it. You understand that? That's what it is. And so it's Russia that had Ukraine on its border overthrown by the West. It's Russia with Al-Qaeda attacking it. It's Russia being destabilized. It's Russia with the Russians are not lobbying to take my guns. Russians are not lobbying to take my private property. Russians are not lobbying that I can't have any kids. They're lobbying people to have kids over there. And I don't lionize them. I know who their faction is. And it's infiltrated by globalists as well. The globalists have the Asian, the Russian, the U.S. and European power blocks playing us off against each other, but only to kill humanity, only to make us bankrupt, only to transfer power to the national security states, which are models that the technocracy needs. They need us fighting with each other to build the technotronic towers, because only technotronic towers can battle a technotronic system. But once we've built the technotronic system for them, then the technocracy of the West, that's much more advanced, believes it can then take over in a Judgment Day Skynet scenario the systems and circumvent humans, merge with the machines, and then kill everybody on the planet. Now, that is the Google plan. Bill Joy told the world about it. That is the Microsoft program. And if you can't handle it, you can't handle the truth, folks. This is in all their major publications that they're going to get rid of everybody and that the singularity will come. But they need global adoption of centralized systems for it to integrate with when they release the AI force. Now, you notice the robots are rolling out. The tanks are rolling out. The armored vehicles, the self-driving cars, the factories are replacing humans everywhere. It's here. You can party a while, play with your iPhone, take drugs if you want, be a nihilist, eat, drink, and be merry, or you can decide to be part of the future and try to defeat this. And so our future progeny and ourselves can enjoy the life extension, enjoy all these great things that are happening. But people are too primitive to understand that they're manipulating us all, that the Palestinian, Israeli, Russian, Dutch, Hispanic, white, black, white, Catholic, Protestant, male, female, and the globalists have told me. I mean, I've met with billionaires and elites and people said, why don't you talk about it? Because it was, you know, meetings in confidence. And they said, look, the public doesn't want to live, and they don't understand what you understand. You are one of us. By extension, you want to survive. Now, join me. You people have no idea what's going on and how much danger you're in. I mean, FBI guys in suits trying to impress people, coming up and intimidating folks in black glasses. Give me a break. You're all full of cancer viruses. You're all being microwaved every day. Your kids are walking dead just like everybody else's. You got to circumvent the whole fake matrix, get outside of it, and go read books by Bill Joy and books by Ray Kurzweil. And the Russian scientists are in their own race with this thing and have public symposiums. Whether it's realizable or not, it's the architecture that the elite are pushing and promoting. It's full spectrum dominance towards the end of not blasting space colonies into space to ensure our species and empower humanity, but to end us. The decision has been made to transcend humanity in the elite's view. You go, oh, that's movie Transcendence, where the good machine takes over, puts nanotech into everything to make sure we're good. And a good human is a dead human. The elite in all their publications, just type, elite believe they're another species. You'll have Times of London, AP, Reuters. It's in all the, they're telling you that they believe they're superior and are going to merge with machines and have copies of themselves. And they're not going to let you or I have access to that without a fight, if you even want access to it. So that transcends red stars on Russian tanks. I will assure you, ladies and gentlemen. John, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, and I really want to believe in Vladimir Putin. I really hope he is a Christian. I really hope that he turned against.
I don't think you should believe in Vladimir Putin, brother. You should pull outside the spectrum. And can you see the pieces on the map? I mean,
I can see. I'm going to keep both eyes open. I'm not a blind follower. I mean, I want to, but I'm still looking at the fact that the globalists said that when they sent Trotsky and Lenin in there, it was a launching pad to take over the world as in a socialist system. And so I got to keep both eyes open as far as make sure he's not still secretly part of this, you know?
Oh, I'm sure he's all. Did you just hear the? I mean, we know who Putin's part of. The reorganized, collapsed Soviet Union that's decided to go with a nationalist model because now they understand through Solzhenitsyn and others and through me. I don't even talk to them, but they listen. I'm not bragging, folks. I mean, the Russian government listens to this show, quotes it, it's on record. That's what's got the CIA so upset. I'm here giving them. I mean, they're smart enough to get Britannic intel. The Russians are smart enough to understand this and to get past the full spectrum false field, false narrative that's been put up. The Russians are understanding that they're slated for total destruction. So that's making them transcend their communism into more of a El Jefe-ism of the chief, which is what the globalists knew in 1900 when H.G. Wells wrote Things to Come. They knew that would be what they would face in the future. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not that China's good or Russia's good. They're different sub-blocks within a contrived battle economically and militarily for global supremacy to build the technotronic systems within each block that the globalists will then engage in an electronic coup of. Do you understand that?
More or less, you're talking about like the bootleg gangs of the 1920s before they consolidated into the organized crime scene to get where they fought each other over territory and stuff.
But yes, but that was laid out publicly. Brzezinski's written 5 books on it. I didn't come up with this. They've all written books. They say they're going to do all this. And like no one will talk about it. Except them and then their own people. And then they say, well, look how dumb the public is. See, they don't even care. I appreciate your call. God bless you, sir.
Alex Jones type of clips. And both of those coupled together, I think, are going to give our listening audience a little bit better idea of what's happening in the Ukraine today. Especially Brzezinski's speech about what's going on the ground, and he's in favor of giving them weapons that will offset any future Russian intrusion into the eastern Ukraine. Of course, we know about the recent MH17 shootdown over there. Now they're even saying that maybe there was a military exercise and the Ukrainians misjudged and shot it down because of a mistake. That's some of the latest. We don't know for sure. There's been other crashes in the world. The magnetosphere, someone is saying that the magnetic sphere or something messed up. So we don't know for sure. But we want to thank each and every one of you tonight for listening. So keep up the good work out there and bless each and every one of you. Thank you.